This is the book is a departure from some of the things you've done in the past. Is that correct?
Well, I've done two other books of nonfiction in the past, but it's certainly the first time I've done a book that I think is so openly didactic. I mean, it's a book of, I think, really designed to help people.
I picked up the book and I turned at random to a number of pages and I said, uh-oh, is this the kind of book that I can do a story on, focusing on literature? And but then as I got further into it, I found that you had alphabetized much of the material here, I guess all of it. Tell me a little bit about the format of the book and what you've done here.
Well, I think the idea of making it alphabetical was in part for the reader and in part for the writer. My idea was to do a book that would be easy to read, and it's not particularly an easy subject, computer. So in order to keep myself under control, I decided to do it as small alphabetical chapters. Some of them are only a few sentences long. Some, I think the longest is about 5 pages. And that was a way of sort of making myself get to the point and not ramble. Another idea was that it was a book that you could pick up and read at any point. And you could just sort of thumb through it. And I hoped that it would make it less threatening than it might be. And the material at the back, which does look very forbidding, is an appendix. You don't have to do that at all.
I want to address a couple of the questions that you raised at the beginning of the book, but I want to ask you a little bit about yourself first and your interest in computers. I think you made reference to the fact that you had an Apple II computer. Is that correct? In the book, didn't you say that that's what you had?
I have a bunch of them. I work with an Olivetti word processor, which is a dedicated word processor. I have a couple of Apples, a very large IBM PC, a TRS-80 Model 100 Sony Typewriter. So I've got I'm one of those people who has several.
Why?
Thinking of more. Well, they all have different uses, you know. The word processor is a word processor. The Apple, I got to do some general kinds of things having to do with film work. The IBM XT is used purely for business. And TRS-80 is a very portable machine that I carry with me all the time and use for some word processing and for some scheduling and so on.
Did you develop an interest in computers because of your writing? You wanted to use the word processing aspects.
Yes, that was how I began. But when I first started with word processing 5 years ago, it seemed to me very, very much not like using a computer. I mean, I think to use an ordinary word processor is like using a very nice typewriter. I mean, you don't have to think that it's a computer ever. And my specific interest in computers as computers began when I started to try and do certain aspects of film production on a machine. No one has ever used computers in film production. That is to say, to design how the money will be spent. And in the course of doing that work, I found myself buying hardware and hiring programmers and doing the whole thing that so many people in other areas have gone through, and for what's in essence a small business.
All right. At the beginning of your book, you raise a number of assumptions. And I'd like for you to explain a couple of these and what you mean by them. Your initial assumption is that people are more important than computers. What do you mean by that?
I don't know. Do you think anybody will argue with me? Maybe. Maybe the computers will. Maybe they'll say, wait a minute, we are more important. No. What I mean by that, I think, is that especially in the early days of computers, and still to some degree now, people will try and design a system that is really satisfactory for machines but not satisfactory for people. And one of the things I feel very strongly about is that to the extent that you use computers or the extent that any of us use computers, that the idea is machines are the servant of man. Man is not the servant of machines. And just because the machine is very complicated and maybe very stubborn is no reason to give in to it. do the little bit of extra effort and make the stupid machine behave as you want it to behave.
All right. Much of what we believe about computers is wrong. What do you mean by that?
I think a great deal is wrong. The most common things that I hear are that they're mathematical. I can't learn that. Only kids can learn that. I mean, the tendency for adults to look at children using computers and to think that therefore they can't do it seems to me a very odd chain of logic. I mean, my idea would be if a 7-year-old can do it, any adult can do it. You know, I mean, the fact that kids can do it ought to be telling us something quite different, which is that they're very easy to do, which is why kids are able to do it. So my feeling is that computers are very unmathematical, that they're quite easy to use in simpler, ordinary ways, and that we should just go ahead and do it.
Okay. It is easy to use a computer. Well, you kind of addressed that, because it's not always easy to use it, at least not until you get to understand it. Is that correct?
My experience is that it's a funny kind of a machine, because I think when most people first get their hands on one or are confronted with one or suddenly find it on their desk or the desk of the person next to them, there's a period of panic, and that panic is more difficult to deal with and to overcome than actually learning how to use the machine. The experience that I've had with people that I've, not only myself, but other people that I've watched go through this process, is that in some odd way, it isn't like, for example, learning to play the piano, where first you have to learn scales and then you can play very simple pieces of music and then you can go into more complicated pieces. There seems to be a sort of watershed where on the one side you know nothing, and then after a period of time you know enough to do almost anything you want. And that period can be passed, so it's like going from chopstick to Mozart in one step. And that's really almost literally true. You know, I see people who are stumbling and having trouble, and over the course of a weekend they come back and they're doing bits and bytes and RAM and ROM, and it means things to them. You know, I think computers are something where you either get it or you don't, and the difference between getting it and not getting it is quite small.
Michael Crichton, you focus primarily on how people at home can make use of the computer and how to understand it. Let's look a little broadly at computers. There's a lot of interest in computers today because of abuse. We've heard about the kid who taps into somebody else's computer system at a hospital or something like that. What is going to happen in the future? What kind of abuse can we see in the future with regard to computers, and how can we stop it?
Well, I think that we're seeing a lot of abuse now. I think no one knows how much. And I think that actually we're going to see less in the future. There are a few reasons to think so. One is that that we're going to start treating people who break into systems, even if they're kids, quite a bit more harshly than we have in the past. But in a more positive way, it's going to become anachronistic very shortly to let data go out on telephone lines, open lines. I mean, people are going to start having secure hard cables to transmit their data if it's important data. And they're also going to start to be monitoring programs built into a system. In other words, there will be a kind of watchdog program in the machine that will look at users and will sample what they're doing and will keep an eye out for people who are unauthorized or who are fumbling around, who don't seem to know the codes, and they'll be cut out of the system.
How will Americans in the future make the most use of computers?
Well, I think there's two answers to that. One is my personal guess, and one is what I think the truth is. The truth now is that nobody knows. I think we're in the very early stages of a very important transformation for the entire society, but we are at the point, for example, say in 1953 or 4, when if I were to say to somebody, at that time, you know, television is going to be the most important political force in history, people would laugh. They go, you know, what are you talking about? It's Uncle Milty. And yet, by 1960, Kennedy was elected, in essence, because of television. And I think now in 1983, it's almost impossible to say what the impact of the machines will be by 1987. Nevertheless, my personal feeling is that they will be important mostly for communications, and that the reason why many, many households will have them and why people will carry them around and so on is exactly why they have telephones and cars, is to be able to communicate.
The computer, the small one that you carry around, what do you do with that? How do you make use of it?
Mostly I use it for word processing. In other words, I write on it. So I can get a call, somebody needs revisions on this, that, or the other. Or I'm actually now writing an article for a magazine that's due in a week after I get back, so I really have to write it now. And I have, in effect, the ability to write my text and to manipulate it.
So you mean you're actually carrying it around with your bus and taxis
right.
and all that?
That's right.
I think there's a lot of confusion in people's minds about how they can make use of a computer. What do I do with it? Play a game? Looking at myself, I don't have a computer, and I'm very interested in one for the purpose of word processing. But I'm trying to think how I can make use of it in other areas other than putting my telephone records in there. How might an average person like myself use a computer other than word processing and games?
I think that the basic categories are games, word processing, business applications, and education. I mean, what everyone does with these machines and communications falls into one of those categories. And my answer to your question is, I think if you end up getting a machine for, let's say, word processing, and you use it for that, and then maybe you put your telephone numbers on it, and then what will happen is that you will then say, oh, well, gee, I've got this machine. Why don't I do this with it? And then you think, oh, I'll do that with it. And this is my sense of how people proceed, which is they start to think of little things that have irritated them. And I don't know what the little things are that have irritated you. But for myself, I have sort of silly things. I'm always troubled in record stores when I go to buy a record by Bach or Brahms or Vivaldi. Somebody I have a lot of records of. I can't remember whether I have that recording or not. So I have it on my machine. This little machine is the size of a machine that took a very large room 10 or 15 years ago. That's what's happened. I mean, it's so mind-boggling that we don't really recognize, because, you know, we're accustomed to seeing, let's say, Cadillacs reduced one-third in size or something like that. But these machines have collapsed on, you know, orders of magnitude. They're thousands of times smaller than they used to be.
One or two other questions, and I want to go back and ask you some personal questions about yourself. Just about all of us have read The Andromeda Strain and The Terminal Man, and we also saw the movies, so we know your reputation as a science fiction writer. Where were you born?
I was born in Chicago. Didn't live there very long, though. I grew up actually in Long Island, Roslyn, Long Island.
Were you educated?
I went to Harvard College and then to Harvard Medical School.
Have you had a practice as a doctor?
Never.
Never?
No. I used to say I retired as a service to my patients, but that's not really true. What really happened to me was that I found that I had written in medical school in order to pay the bills, and at a certain point I decided that that I really liked the writing better than the medicine, and the tail was wagging the dog. So I retired at the age of 26.
Where are you living now?
Los Angeles.
Do you know Robin Cook?
I do know Robin Cook, yes.
Who's also gotten out of the medical profession.
He is also retired, yes.
Well, he's not quite. He's going into motion pictures himself now. He wants to produce his own. I think he's producing Fever, which he turned out a year or so ago.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, he had been very dissatisfied with the way that the producers had handled some of his two of his earlier movies, and so he wanted to try it himself.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you? How did your first novel come about?
My first five or six novels were first five novels were written under pseudonym, and they were all to pay the bills. I was a full-time medical student, and what would happen was I would see a term bill coming up, and I'd just take some time off from school or wait for Christmas vacation or something, knock out a book. They were potboilers. And terrific fun to write, and now mercifully forgotten.
Science fiction?
No, they were mostly spy stories. They were sort of James Bond things with very manly men, lots of guns, and women with heaving chests.
What's wrong with that?
Not a thing.
So it helped to pay the medical bills, then, or the tuition bills?
Yes, it did.
That period, huh?
It did.
But your first important book was The Andromeda Strain, is that correct?
That's right.
Tell me about that. How did you launch that?
Well, I was in my third year of medical school, and I had been trying to write this book and for several years, and I had accumulated about 1,000 pages of manuscripts of false starts and beginnings and bad endings, and all I really had was a title, The Andromeda Strain, which I liked very much and couldn't give up. At one point, I was just going to throw it all out because I was moving and I needed the space and this great stack of paper, and I just thought, no, I'll keep it. I had just changed publishers and had gone to Knopf, which has been my publisher ever since, and I called them up and said, I've been working on this book forever and ever, and I don't know, are you interested in publishing it? And they said, well, show it to us. And I showed it to them, and they said, well, you know, rewrite it. And it was all very casual like that. And then it was published, and it was this big deal, you know. Could have fooled me. I mean, I thought this was an extremely technical book, and who would be interested?
And the impetus hasn't stopped, has it?
No, it's fascinating to me. But I never understand, I guess, why people react to my work. Or maybe I don't try to understand. I mean, mostly my approach is that I write about things that are of interest to me and hope that I'm not the only one, you know, and occasionally I am the only one that's interested, and more often than not, other people seem to be interested, too.
Well, you've certainly done especially, a service in your book, Electronic Life, because I learned a lot about computers, something that I want to know more about, and sometimes I learn some interesting things. I am afraid to program the concept of it for fear of hitting the wrong button and losing it. And you have some very valuable tips, like enter it in the memory every 15 minutes or so the whole thing isn't wiped out at the end of the evening. So you've certainly done a service. My last question, what's ahead? Are you going back to fiction? And if so, can you give us a clue about what you're going to be writing about?
Well, I can give you a clue. I don't know how good a clue it is, but at the moment, my idea is that I'm working on a screenplay, and we'll do a film, and we'll have something to do with computers or high technology, and that the next novel will be set in the time of the American Revolution.
Any science aspects of that?
None at all.
That will really be a departure, won't it?
Well,
you're associated with indeed high tech and science.
Yes, so I've done two historical novels. I did the Great Train Robbery and a book called The Years of the Dead.
But the American Revolution is...
Well, I wanted to do something about that for a long time. I think the American Revolution is a fascinating period, and not really very well understood. We have sort of myths about George Washington and the Delaware. We carry these images in our minds, and they're not, in fact... The myth that we've made out of that event is, I think, much less interesting than the actual event.
Michael Crichton, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.